Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
The 1906 season for the Canton Bulldogs lives on in infamy as this scandal has shook the professional football world as we look at part two of the Canton Bulldogs and our early look at pro football teams coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we have a little bit of a celebration going on here today. This is August 1st, 2022 that this episode's coming out. This marks two straight years of publishing a new podcast every single day, as well as plenty of new articles. We've been doing that for almost two and a half, 3 years now on PigskinDispatch.com. But 365 days of times two of straight podcasts for you with some great football information on PigskinDispatch.com. Well, we are going to use this mark not only to celebrate, but to mark a new tradition. We're entering into season number 3 of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, and we're going to sort of switch things up just a little bit. We are not going to go with new episodes every single day of the week like we have been for the last 2 years, because we are going to go and try to provide you with some other things, try to do some of our YouTube videos, enhance our Jersey Dispatch website in the Sports Jersey Dispatch podcast, do some things on Sports History Network, as well as bring you some new and exciting high-quality podcasts that we're going to do some bigger stories here probably 3 or 4 times during the weekdays of the week. But don't be alarmed. You can go on PigskinDispatch.com any day, and you can pick up our daily history headlines of the football news from the past, and there's a podcast there with every single one of those, so you can catch up and know exactly what's going on in football. So that's just some changes that will be coming up starting this week, and we'll probably go like on a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday type schedule here for a while with new episodes. But don't worry, just subscribe on your favorite podcast provider, or check us out on PigskinDispatch.com or SportsHistoryNetwork.com, and you'll know right when we are releasing the latest episodes for you. So let's get into our story today. We're staying in our early football theme, and we're picking up where we left off last time when we looked at the chronicles of the Canton Bulldogs professional football team. And we found that owner George Williams and captain Blondie Wallace, after that 1905 season, were taking the Bulldogs into some very tumultuous waters of a win-at-all-costs way of running the team prior to the 1906 season. Rival neighboring town Maslin was experiencing smashing success as their hired mercenaries like Bob Schilling were creating a winning tradition there and Ohio championship titles. Maslin added fuel to the fire of this early blossoming pro football rivalry shortly after the Tigers handed Canton that devastating loss that in a way crowned Maslin as the top team in Ohio for 1905. A few days after that, according to the PFRA post in the Coffin Corner titled Ohio Tiger Trap, there's a link for it on PigskinDispatch.com, the Tigers supporters were accusing the Canton program of suffering financial issues and having trouble paying their players from the past season through an article that ended up coming out in a Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper. Now, George Williams retorted back in the press that the payroll and other obligations of the Canton club were being met and their financial stability of Canton Bulldogs was not in question. Many back in Canton figured that this way it was a ploy by Maslin to discredit the Canton Athletic Club to cause trouble with the recruitment of players for the upcoming 1906 season. After all, the Tigers coach Ed J. Stewart had connections to the Cleveland Press and would be just the type of man that would spread false rumor to gain advantage for his club. Now, we keep referring to this as the Canton Bulldogs, and actually it wasn't until midway through the season, 1906 season, that they became the Bulldogs. Prior to that, they were the Canton Athletic Club, the Canton AC, the Canton Athletics, but I'm probably using it in wrong reference, calling them the Bulldogs at this point. The poor gate receipts of 1905 somewhat confirmed the financial woes of the Canton AC, but the local businessmen in Canton seemed more than willing to shoulder the financial burden of the team, at least for the short while. Remember, that era of football in 1906 was not real good. Colleges were shutting down gridiron programs as opponents of the game were rallying for its demise after staggering injury and death tolls mounted, and they were being reported in all types of all the papers, even going as far as going to Washington, D.C., into Congress and in the White House. The college rulesmakers ended up making some amends as they were summoned to the White House, where President Theodore Roosevelt famously pleaded for reform to save the game. The old rulesmakers of the East were soon thrust into a situation of collaborating with other football minds across the country to reform and, in essence, tame the game of football down a few notches. Meanwhile, back in Stark County, Ohio, that was about to get another black eye from the pro circuit was the football game. Both teams from Canton and Massillon dominated all opponents they faced that season, and it was an extremely unfortunate that the two sides never could agree to a scheduled meeting of their teams to play on a field of 1906. All the reports say that they both needed the game, or even two games with each other, to help each other climb out of the hole of heavy payrolls that they were facing. Then it finally happened. The Canton Morning News of October 22, 1906 posted this. They said, quote, "This agreement made on the 20th day of October 1906 by and between C.E. Wallace Jr. of Canton, Ohio, party in the first part, and the Massillon Athletic Club, otherwise known as the Tiger Football Team, Unincorporated Association of Massillon, Ohio, party of the second, that the parties hereto agree that their regularly organized football teams shall play two games of football with each other and share equally in the gate receipts," end quote. It was game on, and more concessions were made to ensure the Canton versus Latrobe game would be played and not interfered with prior to the two scheduled Massillon versus Canton games that were played in November. Also, each team would post $3,000 in guaranteed money that they'd each show up for the scheduled contest. Blondie Wallace took his team to State College, Pennsylvania, to prepare for the games and even got some additional instruction from Penn State's head coach, at the time Tom Fennell, on the use of the forward pass, including practice drills. Massillon, well, they stayed home and prepared diligently themselves. This is a big game, and both sides appeared to be ready to tangle. Now, even the press coverage was unprecedented, as it was reported that the Bell Telephone Company had hired extra men stationed at strategic places to wire developments of the game all around the country via telegraph. The first game lived up to all the hype, as Canton won the game 10-5, with Massillon's only points coming from Tiny Maxwell's scoop and score of a Canton AC fumble. The second game would commence a week later. Now, Coach Edward Stewart pronounced that he would play with the same men that he had lost to Canton the week before, despite rumors that the Tigers were trying to recruit players like Willie Heston and Walter Eckersall, two of the top players of college in the era. But Stewart did, however, produce a ball manufactured by Victor that he wanted to use in a game. Canton complained and wanted to use the ball used normally in the games made by Spalding. Stewart would not come off the use of the Victor ball, though, so the choice was presented to Blondie Wallace. Either forfeit the game and the $3,000 posted as a guarantee, or play the game with the Victor ball. Stewart had set his trap, and the Victor ball was at the heart of the strategy for the game number two. You see, the Victor was a few ounces lighter than the Spalding model. He swapped Peggy Perrott to an end and shifted Homer Davidson to quarterback. Now, it wasn't that Davidson was a better signal caller or even a better passer, but for the mere fact that he was a better punter than Perrott. The combination of a lighter ball and Davidson's catapult leg proved to make a difference as he sailed six punts over the head of Canton safety Jack Hayden. Canton tried to counter by punting on first down, but it was fruitless as Davidson had a much stronger leg than anyone on the Bulldog roster, and thus Massillon gained field position every single time on this exchange. The other new strategy for Maslin in Game 2 was that their offense attacked the edges instead of the middle like they did in Game 1. These tactics finally worked as the Tigers scored on a first-half touchdown to take the lead 5-0 at the half. Remember, touchdowns were 5 points back then. Kant made their halftime adjustments and raced down the field with the help of a rare completed pass and scored a touchdown with a successful extra point to take a 6-5 lead. Maslin again took control of the ball on a drive that went deep into Kant territory, but lost a fumble near the goal line. As was customary in this era, when a team was in the shadow of their own goal line, Canton wanted to punt themselves out of trouble. A powerful rush by Maslin on the play, though, knocked one of the Bulldogs' tackles into the path of the ball, and a kick careened off him and back through the goal line for a safety. Maslin took the lead back 7-6, and it was a breaking point for Canton as they gave up another Tiger touchdown and lost the state title to Maslin by the tune of 13-6. Of course, as was the case in most big ball games, there were some high-stake wagers won and lost in that contest. Tensions were high, and there were even some altercations that broke out that had to be broken up by police that evening at some local watering holes. The big fight, though, would start a couple days later on Monday morning when the Maslin Independent newspaper, it was reported that Ed Stewart charged that Blondie Wallace and others tried to bribe some of Maslin's players to throw the contest. When their attempts failed, it is speculated by many that Wallace instructed a few of his own players to throw the game and let Maslin win so as to capitalize on some lucrative bets made on a Tigers victory. Distinguished historian Dr. Harry Marsh, in his book titled Pro Football, Its Ups and Downs, wrote this, quote, after the second game, the Maslin Independent openly accused Wallace of trying to frame the games with Maslin players, and failing in this, he persuaded one of the Canton players to deliberately cross up his fellows and throw the game. When the accused by his teammates, his player said he simply obeyed orders as he was accustomed to do. At any rate, he left town hurriedly, on the first train, in his playing togs, his belongings following later. Maybe. Wallace sued the Maslin paper for libel and said that they had the evidence that the case was soon withdrawn, and so his own attorneys admitting the hopelessness of their contention. End quote. Dr. March would also know, too, as he was there in Canton and involved with the team of the Canton Athletic Club before he went on to help make the New York Giants franchise a viable team in the 1920s. Dr. March recalled that Eddie Wood left town in a hurry when it was learned that Wallace was the one convicted to do the deeds that would ensure a Maslin victory at the orders of Blondie Wallace. While other members of the Bulldogs were unaware of the treachery, Wallace was grilled by the mob of fans, but he was cool and easily explained all the way the suspicions and matters, including those of Wood and the end instead of the reliable Gilchrist who was injured. The fans left seemingly satisfied with Blondie's explanations. But what the throng of accusing fans have forgotten was that Stewart had said a few of his players had been approached to throw the game, and not that they were the other way around. Reports soon surfaced that Walter East had approached Bob Shiring and Tiny Maxwell, and both Maslin players immediately reported the incident. This incident, however, took place in the first game and was reported to have been nipped in the bud. This now explains better why Walter East may have been released by the club after having such a banner season. The scandalous rumors ended up causing only a small crowd to show up for the previously scheduled Latrobe and Canton game. The Bulldogs lost gate money they so desperately needed, and Blondie Wallace was broke. In an effort to climb out of the hole, he filed lawsuits for libel against the Maslin newspaper, Stewart, and others by the tune of $25,000. Some big money then. The Bulldog players had not been paid, and many were stuck in Canton without funds to even return home. Many of the Maslin 11 went to Canton and helped put on a third benefit bowl to raise needed funding for these players, but only about 500 fans showed up. The game is forever shrouded in deceit as members of both teams became embroiled in a bitter alleged betting scandal. And there were off-field bettings that took place and newspaper accusations, subpoenas, barroom brawls, and everything over this. So this scandal so shocked the town of Maslin that the franchise did not play a game for years. The Canton team, well, they resurfaced after a few years of obscurity in the semi-pro ranks in 1912 with the help of a young man that watched the Tigers-Bulldogs games while growing up, a guy by the name of Jack Kuzak. And when we come back next week to talk about part three of the Canton Bulldogs, Kuzak will be part of this feature. So we hope you enjoyed this little bit of football history of the 1906 scandal of the Canton Bulldogs and Maslin Tigers, and give you a little bit of more history on the Canton Bulldogs franchise. So till tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.